shares, market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our bonus mailbag edition. If you've been listening for a couple of days, you'll know that on Friday or Saturday this week, whenever our good friends at Triple M actually hit the podcast airwaves, we promised you a bonus mailbag episode. We've had that much great correspondence from our listeners that we wanted to do it justice. We didn't want to leave any out. And so we're kind of doing a bit of a catch-up episode, Doc. I'm Scott Phillips. With me, as always, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. You still well?
I am still very well. Well, actually, you know, I really love the mailbag.
So you
I'm,
too.
I'm more
You're
than
a huge
well.
Mailbag fan.
I'm a huge mailbag fan. I'm a fan of all the people who send us questions.
Whenever we talk about you, always say, I love the mailbag. That's my favorite bit.
It's just my favorite bit. So, yeah, I can send you questions. Even if you don't say you like it, it's still fine. I love the questions.
Oh, it's not as fun.
That's true.
Mate, we did some mailbag on our Friday normal episode. We've also got a mailbag question of sorts coming up this Tuesday in our Money Hacks edition. That's right, you get three Motley Fool Money episodes in this seven-day period. The Money Hacks edition this week, I won't give too much away. Suffice to say, it came from Max on Twitter who asked us a question, and we're happy to answer Max's question. So, Max, if you are listening now, stay tuned for a couple of days and we will be answering your question. And whether you're already investing or just getting started, or have people who are looking to get started investing, the Money Hacks episode, I think, we'll tick a couple of boxes there. Mate, let's get on with the mailbag, though. The first question comes from Zoiks on Twitter, at Zoiks, which is kind of a fun... It feels a bit Scooby-Doo. Is it Scooby-Doo? Is it Zoiks?
I have no idea.
Shaggy used to say? I can't remember. Anyway, we started in form. Zoiks says, and just a bit of feedback, which we also love, he says, hey, in one of your recent Learn to Invest Money Hack shows, your doc mentioned IG as a broker. Might be worth pointing out that there is a $50 a quarter fee if you don't make at least three trades in this time frame. So probably not suitable for the starting investor. I think that's really, really great feedback. Thank you, Zoiks. I didn't know that. I don't know if you did, Doc, and I don't know which one of us mentioned IG.
I must have mentioned it. I actually don't use it. I've just heard about it. I think Kevin Gandia, who works with us in the Fool and a couple of our services, he I think, mentioned IG. Maybe he uses it. So I did not know.
So just be careful here. And look, as with all of these decisions in investing, let me be a little bit cynical. Everybody's out trying to find ways to take your money off you, right? So if they give you a nice little, hey, it's only going to cost you a couple of bucks a trade, and then they say, well, by the way, we'll charge you 50 bucks if you don't trade, that can meaningfully change the value proposition, right?
Yeah. So the one thing I'm going to quickly add here is that any broker out there, you can basically pick up your phone, call their help number, and say, I need a better deal. And most of these guys, if they want your business, are going to give you something.
There you go.
Yeah. So I've done that a number of times. And, you know, they give you free trades. So they would, you know, remove that $50 fee. You know, they would do. And again, like, I mean, their incentive is really to keep you with them because over time, that's how they're going to make money off you. Right. Mm. So by charging you stuff, which is going to result in you disappearing. Well, you know, and it's not very hard here to change your broker, right? So I think you can give a call to your broker. If you like your platform, give a call to your broker and ask for a deal.
Good advice. But also, as I said, when you're signing up, just be careful of the fine print. Look at things like inactivity fees or monthly fees. They're going to charge you on top of just the brokerage amount. So, Zoiks, thank you very much for giving that extra context. And if you are thinking about a broker, have a look at IG in that context. We've mentioned others as well. I'll re-mention Comsec. I think Saxo is yours, mate, from memory.
So Saxo, one of the things to keep in mind with Saxo is Saxo actually charges a fee off the total assets under management. It's 0.11%.
There you go.
That can add up.
That can hurt.
That can hurt, right? So I mean, you're trading off low, you know, if you're trading on the ASX, you pay $6.95, one of the lowest actually that's available.
It's cheap until you consider the...
Then on the other side, you consider that. So again, there are trade-offs everywhere. Yeah.
Sometimes things are too good to be true. Let's move on to a question from Shawnee Burke on Twitter. I don't know if that's Sean I. Burke or Shawnee. In any case, maybe just Sean. It says, afternoon, gentlemen. I've only just come across your podcast a month or so ago, but as I have enjoyed it so much, I am now up to date. Sean, dude. Get a life. There's got to be more important things to do to catch up with all of that. There's almost 100 and something. How many podcasts are we up to?
A lot.
We can't be far off 200, you know?
Probably more.
Sean, seriously, dude, have a good hard look at yourself. No, thank you for listening. We appreciate it. And if we are giving you something worth listening to, then we are humbled. So thank you. He says that the segs are particularly enjoyable along with the banter. That must be my brother, Sean, is it? Or your brother, Sean?
My brother,
Sean. Got to be family.
Yeah.
I was hoping to get you to discuss why AIA and SYD have such different PEs. Now, Sean, bring it in tight, dude. You've obviously not been listening quite long enough to know that I have a pathological dislike for stock codes. Now, it's not a big deal. although it's a little bit of a big deal, isn't it? I give the guys a hard time at work.
You give a really hard time. But even AIA is what? Australian Insurance?
Auckland Airport.
Auckland Airport.
Auckland Airport. And this is kind of why, right? So if we start thinking about ticket codes. I know. If you start thinking about ticket codes, we start to think about stocks, you know, tickers, you know, charts on a screen or moving share prices. It just kind of breaks that mental link between a company or the shares and the company itself. Now, we all know it's a company, right? So you kind of go, okay, yeah, I know that. The thing is, we know that from behavioral psychology that the more we kind of distance ourselves from these two things, the less we remember to think about the businesses themselves. So is it a big deal? No. Is it the same thing? Yes. Subconsciously, we've got to be so careful of these behavioral biases and traps that we can fall into. And my way of overcoming them is requiring all of our team, much to their dislike, and they're probably nodding their heads in furious agreement right now as they're listening to this, assuming they do, of course, that we don't use stock codes. We only ever use company names. So I will give you that the pass mark this time, Sean, but if you message us next time, don't forget. So, mate, Auckland Airport and Sydney Airport are the two questions. Now, they're both airports. They're both reasonably exposed to domestic and local tourism, international tourism, but they have such different PEs, even though they are in the same sector. My initial thoughts were market sentiment for Sydney airports. Also, the numbers look better for Auckland Airport. I look forward to hearing your response and agreeing to potentially disagree on this one. Thanks, Sean. I'm not sure if Sean thinks he's going to disagree with us or we're going to disagree with each other. So we might have to bring it back. Sean, I'm going to give you a boring answer to start with, and then we'll get on to the businesses themselves. Part of the reason with these guys is that the structures for infrastructure, particularly in Australia, are really, really, really messy. Now, if you think about the earnings of these businesses, there is so much debt loaded and loaded and loaded and loaded on top of these. I'm thinking about Transurban, Sydney Airport, any of these infrastructure companies. The government basically allows them, largely because they are either private-public partnership kind of partners or because they're bought public assets like Sydney Airport. They've basically structured them so they can take on an absolute truckload of debt, knowing that, of course, there's always going to be people using Transurban's roads or Sydney Airport's airport, funnily enough, that they can afford to take on literally mountains of debt, like just phenomenally large, overbearing, almost crushing amounts of debt. What that does is it makes the PE look absolutely tiny. There's also a whole lot of accounting tricks that go on in the background to really mess with the way it looks. So for both Sydney Airport and Auckland, and frankly, Auckland's a New Zealand infrastructure company, of course, with any of these infrastructure businesses, always look at the cash flow, not at the earnings. And so to some degree, I won't say it's misleading because it's not. It's exactly, they are complying with the accounting rules as written. The numbers are real. The earnings are real, at least in terms of the way they're presented. They're just not very helpful for investors making investment decisions. And so I really would encourage you, and this is really important, right? This is, I guess I will say, partly why, as much as I was kidding before, why it's really important to look at the businesses themselves, not just the stock codes, is comparing PEs in this case actually is really, really potentially very misleading unless you understand what's going on behind the scenes and the way these businesses are structured. So that's a kind of a boring accounting answer, but it's really important. It's why, if you think about these businesses, how they're making money, what sort of debt have they got in the balance sheet, how they're paying that debt off, what does that do to the accounts? That's why it's really, really important. So I would not at all, frankly, for these infrastructure companies, look at PEs. I simply would ignore them. They are less than useless. In fact, misleading makes it sound like it's intentional, so I don't want to convey that, but they are completely, completely, completely useless when it comes to trying to assess the value of these businesses. Doc, your thoughts?
You know, I have nothing to add on that one. Like, really nothing. They're airports, they're boring, they pay dividend.
What's boring about dividends coming into the bank account every 6 months? I'll take it. Come on.
Yeah. Look, I mean,
why do you hate cash?
I didn't say I hate cash. I guess it's just not exciting for me.
Who wants money? I don't want money.
Oh, so I reserve my right to not know much about airports and say thank you, but no thanks.
Fair to say airports don't really kind of tick your normal investing box, do they?
Even abnormal investment box. I wouldn't dare
to call you abnormal, mate. That is part of the reason, Sean. Interesting, if you look at the yields, currently Sydney Airport at 4.8, Auckland Airport at 2.5, interestingly enough. So while Auckland seems cheaper, in air quotes, on a PE basis, it's actually also much less attractive from an income flow basis. Even with dividends, you'd be a little bit careful there as well because, again, the cash flows are different. So you've got to value these infrastructure companies as a rule. This for anyone listening who's looking at infrastructure businesses, pipelines, airports, toll roads, what am I missing, mate? Bridges, anything that's infrastructure, always, always, always look at the cash flow statement and make sure you understand where the money's coming from.
You could look at data centers too.
Data centers, exactly, same kind of idea. Mm. Man, they're not tech companies either, speaking of our
they're not tech.
Friday podcast. Yeah. We'll rant about that another day. Okay. Stand by.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
My question from Brett, I love this question because it goes to some of the questions that beginner investors have, and also we can be a little bit guilty sometimes of presuming that we know the answers and not necessarily explaining ourselves as well as we could. So Brett says, hi guys, I have a question for your magnificent podcast.
Magnificent.
What's that? Extra points for that one. Basic assumption is that in the current climate, my money is better off in investments rather than paying down my mortgage. But wouldn't this only be the case if my investments are at the same value as my mortgage? What is my brain missing? Looking forward to your answer. Do you want to first go that or will I take this one?
Well, I can have a rough go. I'm sure you'll have a better answer.
I doubt it very much.
Yeah. So first of all, let's say you've got a mortgage. Right? Mm-hmm. Let's say you've got a $500,000 mortgage.
Yes.
And you've got an offset account where you're paying down into your mortgage, mm-hmm. But you decide to pay ahead, mm-hmm. and on that. If you pay ahead, basically, let's say you've got a 3.5% is your interest, then, yep. That's what you're really saving, right? You're yep. really saving. You're basically getting a return on that in some sense of 3.5%.
Yeah.
Right? Instead, if you could...
Your wealth is improving by that amount.
Yep. If you could invest in something that gives you 10%, mm-hmm. then you are significantly better off.
Yes.
Now, of course, you have to consider the fact that when you're paying down your mortgage, you're not paying tax on that. So, there's no tax implication. There's tax implication depending upon how you're investing.
Right.
So
you're 10%, but you pay capital gains tax of, let's say the top marginal tax rate to make life easy, 24%, because you can half that. So if you're 10 bucks, you get to keep $7.60.
Yeah. You're still ahead, right?
Of now, your $3.50 otherwise you might have saved.
Right. And then the advantage is that the 3% compounding, it will take what, like 25 years for your money to double?
Close enough to.
Something like that.
Yep.
Whereas at 7%, it'll actually double in 10 years. So right. So over a long, like a mortgage is over a long period of time, right? Mm-hmm. So if you put the primary goal as paying down your mortgage, and which you might, or you might decide to pay substantially because that's a comfort thing, mm-hmm. What makes you sleep better at night and so on and so forth, right? But if you prioritize that, then you'll actually never invest,
yep.
and you'll never get the benefits of compounding. So
yep.
that's I think where the value is from the long term compounding that you're going to get by investing in assets that return more than what a bank interest rate.
Right. Now, if you're paying 6% on your mortgage and you're getting 7.5% after tax in your investments, you still might think, well, that's kind of close enough to be, in the world of these things that are always fuzzy. You might still go, oh, I'll pay the mortgage off because it's close enough that it's not that different.
Yeah.
And I might as well get the peace of mind, as you say. I think what Brett's asking actually, Doc, is I think he's comparing the $1,000 he's got to invest now with his $500,000 mortgage. And so, hang on, if I get 10% of my $1,000, but I'm paying 3.5% of my $500,000 mortgage, aren't I still better off to do the mortgage because it's a larger amount? I think that's a really good question. But I think, Brett, if that is the reason for your question or the basis of your question, it is tempting to look at the two amounts separately, but I think that's sort of a bit misguided. You're kind of misleading yourself a little bit here because you're not looking at the whole value of either of the two. Your question really is, say you've got $1,000 in the back pocket now, you just got a bonus or you sold your car or you knocked over a little old lady. Don't do that. Please don't do that. And you've got $1,000, right? The only question for you is not the total value of your investments or the total value of your mortgage. The only question is, with that $1,000, what is the best return for that money? Now, if you pay $1,000 off your mortgage at 3.5%, you'll save $35 a year. Okay, that's just what's going to happen because you're not paying interest on that money that's going in. So for the first year, you'll pay $35 less in interest than you would have had you not put the $1,000 on your mortgage. So that's the first thing. If you did get 10%, and we should say, by the way, the stock market is super volatile, right? So you might lose 10% in the first year and you'll feel worse off. But on average and over the long term, if you invested $1,000 in the stocks and you got a 10% return, you'd make $100 with that $1,000. So the question for you is, where do I put the $1,000? Now, if you're like me, if you're like Doc, you're going to say, well, hang on, if I can invest that at 10%, I'd rather make $100 in profit than save $35 in interest because I'm $65 better off. Even if you take tax out of it at the top rate, I'm making $75 in profit or I'm saving $35 in interest. Again, still much, much better off to make that extra money because your net wealth is increasing by more by making money rather than paying money off the interest on the mortgage. So if that was the basis of your question, I think it might have been. That's why I'd be looking at that particular question. So you always want to say, with the extra dollar or $10 or $100 or $1,000 I've got, where is the best after-tax return and what should I do with that money? And for us, other than the peace of mind element of paying down the mortgage, which is super, super valuable for a whole lot of people, if you're talking purely rationally, we'd say you're getting a much better return if you invest that money. How'd I do?
I think you did very well.
Thank you, mate.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, Doc, the next question comes from Jackson. Jackson and I had a bit of to and fro on Facebook. Again, at The Motley Fool, are you on Facebook or I'm at Scott Phillips Money? You're not on Facebook, so I won't. I'm not being rude by ignoring you. I'm just not.
No, I used to be. I still have a profile which I've not deleted, but you know, I just don't use Facebook.
But in a professional capacity, you have a profile, as do I, but we also have a public Facebook page.
I don't do Facebook.
Jackson says, "Hey guys, I was wondering if you have any securities trading advice or guides for millennial investors focusing on long-term investing. Thanks heaps, Jackson." Now, I went back to Jackson and said, look, you know, I don't have much and wonder why you're asking, what would you like? And so he replied, and this is worth just throwing the reply in. He says, "Thanks so much for your reply. I'm a pretty avid reader of Motley Fool's content in general. The reason I asked the question is, although it's great your content is applicable to a broad audience base, I was wondering if there were any specific guides or general articles that help understand the right mindset to have as a millennial investor, given the advantage of having a longer lead time for our investments to compound. As such, I was curious as to if you had any resources that explain what would be the most beneficial to millennial investors in terms of thought processes, like whether to invest actively or passively, what proportion of a total portfolio would be ideal to divert to active and passive, and what the ideal asset allocation is for 20-somethings like myself. I guess the crux of what I'm trying to ask is if you have general investment advice for investors at different life stages and risk profiles. To be honest, I'm not completely sure how or if I should structure my investments portfolios similar to someone aged in their 50s or 60s. This isn't something that schools or universities give much attention to, so I've learnt the bulk of my knowledge from talking with those who advise on and research these topics day in, day out. All the best, Jackson." Jackson, like we mentioned about our previous bloke, was it Zoix? Was he the... No, who was the 23-year-old?
Ireland.
Very good. Jeremy. We will. So look, Jackson, fantastic questions, mate. Again, like with Jackson, like with Jeremy, you are just super on it, mate. Frankly, you don't need to do much right. You could actually do badly as an investor, relatively speaking, from here, and still make a squillion. So keep in the easy answer, and it's kind of the reason I struggled with Jackson's question, Doc, when I was kind of going backwards and forwards is. The reality is the investment advice we give is pretty much applicable to anybody at any life stage because it doesn't change that much, right? It's because it's not so much about the investor, it's about the investing. It's about what you do, what you invest in, how you think about maximizing the returns from your cash. And that kind of, our advice doesn't change. If you're 8 or 80 and you're saying to me, what's the best long-term investing strategy? It's kind of exactly the same. There is no difference. And so I did struggle with to answer the question because it feels almost like I'm copping out or, you know, it's easy with investing. There's so many people out there who want to make this complex. Mm. So many people who'll take your money by giving you specific advice or tailored solutions, as they like to call it. And that feels somehow smarter. When someone like me or someone like you says, "Oh, it's all the same for everybody," you go, "That can't be true. You guys are obviously just not paying enough attention. Give me something specific. Tell me exactly what I should do," right? And so we can make a lot more money if we pretended we had specific advice for particular people in particular circumstances. Now, that said, there are some answers to some of these questions. Do you have a general thought, or will we get into Jackson's questions?
Well, I was going to give some.
Excellent.
I was going to pretend that there's something specific.
I've completely destroyed your argument. Now you're going to have to try and make it anyway. All right. Good luck.
So number one, I think the biggest advantage is if somebody's 20 something, they have this huge long road ahead. Right.
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. So I think that's where I think building a lot of knowledge and. You know, figuring out your investment style, what works for you, mm-hmm. you know, your investment temperament.
Mate, if I could take my current environment and everything I know now,
yeah.
I think I would give away almost all of my money to get to starting it at 20.
Yeah.
Like quite literally because I know that I would do a better job of saving better, investing better.
Yeah.
Being able to put the old head on young shoulders. Like I think I would literally give up almost literally everything I physically own if I could start again.
You're starting again, like at 20, and thinking that you can invest for the next 40 years. So that's a huge advantage.
I'm
so that's number one.
Super jealous.
So super jealous of that. At the same time, I'll say that, you know, like he asked questions about active and passive, and, you know,
that was the first question.
You know, like it's a passive investing via ETFs. Like, I mean, they have a role, but if you have that kind of time in front of you and you are a, you know, dedicated and interested investor, I would almost always invest in individual securities. And because you have the opportunity of finding these huge compounding benefit, you know, compounding machines, right? That's one. The only thing I would suggest is if somebody is in that 20 something, and this is something that we say to people at any stage, think about learning about behavioral biases that affect investing returns, right? I think that's probably the single biggest detractor to returns is, you know, basically simple, stupid mistakes that we always make because we are wired that way, right? And I'll make a book recommendation for that. There's a great book, which is easy. This is good. I'll change from great to good. It's a good book, but it's very easy to understand. I think it's targeted towards, you know, investors who want to sort of improve their behavioral side, their temperament. It's called the Little Book of Behavioral Investing.
Such a good book
By James Montier. It's a good book. It's a cracker. It's easy to read that if you can sort of, you know, internalize, actually you'll do really well.
Yep.
And I think, and as such, the Little Book series has got a lot of other good books that you could read. But I would say that read a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, read from the greats, read some of these good books, follow through and, you know, just basically build on your temperament, and that would really serve you well.
I completely agree. I'm going to take a slightly different view to you, actually, Doctor, in this one. I'm going to suggest that passive is a really great place for maybe many people to start. So again, I think to Doc's point, as each investor, you need to think about, who am I as an investor? What do I want out of my investing career, right? Now, if you're super switched on, you love the idea of investing, you love the idea of businesses, it just does it for you, right? Which is Doc and I and other people in our business. If that's your thing, then go and get stuck into individual companies. Learn about investing, learn about valuation, learn about the sorts of returns that other investors get and how they've got them. Learn about some of the, I won't say tricks because it makes it sound too opaque, but some of the strategies that investors, successful investors have used to do really, really well. That's a really great place. That's where I started. I've been investing in individual stocks for as long as I can remember. I think I own one ETF. So I've been an active guy pretty much my whole investing life. And if that's you, then great. Keep doing that, as Doc said. The only thing I would say is if you're not sure or you don't want to or you're building confidence or something else, you may want to start with a bit of both, a bit of passive and a bit of active. The reality is simply if you just passively invest, you keep your fees low, you'll do fantastically well. And that's all you'll actually need to do. If you get nothing from this other than I'm going to invest $1,000 a month or $1,000 a quarter or whatever you can afford and put that aside for as long as you possibly can, you'll end up with $1,000,000 even if you just invest in ETFs. If you want to try and beat the market, even improve that return meaningfully, and that's what Doc and I try and do day in, day out with our professional jobs and with our personal portfolios, then yes, absolutely go active. There is no kind of age-based answer to that, though. If someone was 65 and saying, look, I've got to put some money aside, I don't really care about this investing caper, I just know I should do it, help me do it simply, we'd say, be passive. If someone said, I'm 65 and I love investing and I want some stock recommendations and I want to buy individual companies, then we say, great, be active. So that's 65, that's 45, that's 25, that's 12, that's 85. There really is no age-based solution for that. And again, I know, Jackson, it feels like I'm copying out by saying there is no difference, but I just don't think there is. I think you can pretty much, the act of saving and investing itself is the only thing that matters. But just be careful with your investing. Try and keep doing it regularly. Try and avoid some of the pitfalls, as Doc said. Just read as much as you can. The Essays of Warren Buffett is wonderful. One Up on Wall Street is wonderful. The Little Book of Behavioral Investing is fantastic. I've listened to that on audiobook and I've read it in physical form. It is great. So many great examples of the things that can really mess with your head and stop you investing well. Just try and overcome those. Keep putting money away. Keep investing no matter what the market's doing, no matter what the punters are saying about the market's toppy or cheap or expensive or any of that sort of stuff. Just invest regularly. You will absolutely be glad you did. Anything else on that, mate?
No, man. That's awesome.
Beautiful. All right. We're going to go to a question from Russell. Russell says, can you recommend something for me? The market is very high at the moment. Well, an ETF like VGB, more stock codes, Doc, killing me here.
What is VGB?
Let's find out. Will an ETF like VGB be a good place to park money right now? Now, mate, VGB is a Vanguard bond fund. Australian government bond index specifically. So rather than buying government bonds from the government directly or through a financial intermediary, you get to buy an ETF, a fund made up of Australian government bonds. Now, in this case, we, you know, basically Russell said, look, I don't really feel like investing in the market, but I want to put money somewhere. Should I invest in bonds? What do you say?
I am not a bond market investor.
You're the antithesis of a bond market investor.
And definitely not a bond market investor where the bonds, the returns on the yields on bonds are dropping like, I don't know what they are, but they're dropping like they're very heavy rocks in this really thin environment. So, I mean, some of the bonds might actually have negative yields.
Some international bond. There was a great episode on another podcast. We don't think you should listen to too many other podcasts because ours is the best.
Yeah.
Don't waste your time. No, I'm kidding. Planet Money. I think it was Planet Money or The Indicator. The Planet Money team do both. They did a great episode on bonds only in the last week or so, I think. Mm. The Vanguard Bond Fund in the US, the sort of the global bond fund, actually owns a heap of bonds. And I want to say billions worth, maybe even trillions, but certainly billions worth of bonds that are negative yielding out of Germany, out of Switzerland, both company bonds and government bonds. So it's a tough old place to be. Mate, so what are you saying? We shouldn't be investing in bond funds?
I would not be doing it. That's my, I have no bonds. I have no intent of bonding with any bonds.
not even James Bonds?
James Bond is different. That's a different type of bond. I could go watch a James Bond movie, but yeah, I just don't see any reason to, it actually, you know, I find it baffling that people are, you know, willing to pay other people, hey, I'm going to give you my money. And you know what? I'm going to give you some money to actually keep my money.
Yeah.
And I'll get it back from you later. I'll take less from you, but that's okay.
I'll give you $100 now. In 5 years' time, can you please give me back $95.50?
Yeah. It's baffling.
It's bizarre.
You know, it's really bizarre.
Now, in Russell's defense, though, if he's right, let's say the stock market was to drop 20%, you actually be better investing in bonds because you might lose maybe a percent. Maybe you won't actually. Australian government bonds are positive. So you'll make something in 5 years' time. Maybe you get $101.50 back or something. Surely that's better than losing 20% on the market if the stock market's overvalued.
But if you want to do that, why wouldn't you just put it in a term deposit?
Well, because bonds are better than cash and you're getting a better return. And
well, are you really? I don't know. You go to Me Bank and I'm just...
All right. So are you saying Russell should be investing in term deposits instead?
Well, if you want really that type of returns, then why wouldn't you without knowing how much money it is and so on. So if you're trying to invest a lot of money.
And we can't give personal advice anyway.
Right. So if somebody was investing $1 million and they needed to buy a term, though that term deposit would not be guaranteed by the government because there's a ceiling, right? The government cuts over, what, $200,000, $250,000?
$250,000, I think.
Right. So if you have $1 million and you want to put
First-class problem, by the way.
If you've got $1 million, a first-class problem, and you don't actually want it in the bank because the bank only guarantees $250,000,
right.
You give it to the government and say, okay, I buy your bond and that's higher guarantee. nothing is again guaranteed in this world, right? But that's okay, that's pretty much as close as it gets to guarantee. So yeah, if that's the problem, then sure. But if it is a problem that I want to put some small amount of money relatively small amount of money that's going to be guaranteed, then I would just take a term deposit and get a higher return.
Yeah.
That's what I would do. But yeah, if you've got the first class problems of several $1 million, then
All right, term deposits or stocks?
Stocks.
Why?
Well, you know, I like to bet on human ingenuity and the fact that as human beings, we are always looking to excel and do something, at least collectively.
Okay, but if the market's overvalued, surely there's better times to invest.
Yeah, I mean, it does, you know, the market gets overvalued every now and then. But, you know, like you take any great company stock and, you know, I'll use my favorite company Apple.
We went a whole podcast and we actually went two podcasts. We recorded a couple today.
Yeah.
And we didn't say,
because we did this on Twitter. We did a lot of,
we had
the Apple feed. But like, you know, at various points in time, you could have said, oh, this looks expensive. It looks, you know, more expensive. I should sell out and things like that. But, you know, in various points of time, you could bought the stock and still done really, really well.
Yep.
Right. The thing is that, you know, innovative companies find innovative ways to keep growing, keep doing things that, you know, so I mean, you're basically betting on excellence. And if you're betting on excellence, then the place to bet on excellence, and I'm using Apple as an example, you could use anything that is excellent. And you could, you know, something like Macquarie Group, for example, is another example of a bank that is, it's a bank, but it's a very different type of bank. And then it's a very innovative company. They have got a culture of innovation, and you could bet on it. And I looked at it recently, and since IPO, I believe it has returned 7,000%.
That's a lot.
Total shareholder return.
That's a lot.
Right. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, there are portions and periods of time, like, you know, for example, during the GFC when the stock was cut really, really badly.
Yep.
But, you know, like, I think that you can't get that 7,000 type of return by not being in the share market, right? I mean, you know, the only other place you can probably get that return is by being a private investor in a VC company, you know, basically being a VC investor and willing to take that risk.
And you can still be wrong, right?
And you can still be wrong. But really, that's the place. I mean, that's the betting on people doing well, betting on people, the society, you know, improving over time, betting on the economic growth and economic development as a whole of the world continuing. That's what the stock market basically gives you. An opportunity to participate.
Now, I'm going to challenge that from Russell's perspective, but then actually agree with you in the end. So Russell might say, yeah, that's all fine, and I'll do that, but I'll do it when the shares are a bit cheaper because I don't want to pay high prices now. I love to buy Apple, but I'll buy it when it's cheaper. And I think what I would say, Russell, is it's always obvious in hindsight where the market tops are. And if we go back in a time machine, I promise you I can make a fortune. The problem is we can't know that. And there's a litany of articles written by every well-meaning and sometimes not so well-meaning bears or investment banks or stockbrokers. There's a famous one from the bank RBS in 2016.
Royal Bank of Scotland, January 2016. Sell everything.
Right.
Sell everything.
Which in hindsight would have been remarkably expensive. Now, they, I'm sure, with every good intention, with a whole lot of smart people, with computer models and all that sort of stuff, looked at the market and went, too high. Sell everything. Tell it all out of you. Now, if the market had dropped the next day, they would have been geniuses. And frankly, the bloke who said that, or the girl who said that, would have been, wouldn't have bought themselves a beer or dinner for the next 5 years, right? There's plenty of people who predicted, in air quotes, the 07 crash, 08 crash, who've still never bought themselves a beer because they get to say, oh, I was the guy who predicted this and predicted that. It's so easy to look at a market and say, oh, I think it's expensive. Now, sometimes you're right. And Russell, you may well be right. That's a very, very high chance, though, that of all the people who make these predictions, a very small, tiny proportion are right. And even those who are right are probably more lucky than right, because most of the perma bears have been saying the market's too high now for the last 10 years. There were people who predicted a double dip recession in 2009, right? So you fast forward through there, people were getting out of Chinese stocks in 2011 because there was supposed to be a China hard landing coming. In 2016, RBS said sell everything. There's always reason to look at a market and say, I think it's expensive. Now, sometimes it will be. Our view, generally speaking, is dollar cost averaging. And we'll talk about that in a second, by the way. But broadly speaking, is the market expensive now? I don't know. You don't know. Again, it's one of those things we talked about, you know, we seem like we're somehow negligent by not having a view from a millennial versus a 30-year-old versus a 50-year-old versus a 20-year-old versus a 70-year-old. Surely we're supposed to know these things, right? There must be something complex and difficult because that's what the financial industry has told you. The financial industry will also tell you exactly where they think the market's going to be by December 31. Where's the market going to be by the end of the year? Where's the market going to be by Christmas? Nobody knows. That is the secret of investing, right? The secret of the financial world that no one wants you to know is no one has any bloody idea. Nor do we. The difference is we get to say it because our organization lets us rather than pretending we know all these sophisticated, wonderful things so you'll pay us a fortune. So honest answer, mate, I don't know where the market is. Does it seem expensive? On some metrics, yeah. Some stocks, yeah, absolutely. Am I going to still invest regularly in the best ideas I can find month in, month out, or invest in an ETF month in, month out? Yes, absolutely. Because if I'm wrong and the market's too low or too high, I keep investing. When I'm finally, air quotes, right, maybe the market falls from there. But if I invested all the way through, if I'd invested from 2007 to today, instead of, you know, listening every time someone said it was too expensive, I'm so much better off. And if this ended up being the top, well, so be it. I'd much rather stay in stocks though, because there's every good chance that I'm wrong. And B, over the long term, as Doc said, buying great quality companies, holding it for the long term, is still the smartest way we know to make money.
Nothing to add.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
I've got a question from Pete on Twitter. Pete says, hey, Anirban Mahanty and Scott P. Well, actually, I'll give us the four ones. Hey, at Anirban Mahanty. And hey, at TMF Scott P. That's our Twitter handles. Hit us up on Twitter. I've been listening to the Motley Fool AU podcast all year and have enjoyed the ride so far. Thanks, Pete. One thing I haven't heard much about is employees making extra contributions to their super as a method to buy indices by dollar cost averaging. Are they similar? I love this question because it's such a smart, thoughtful way of thinking about dollar cost averaging. In fact, bringing a real world example of dollar cost averaging straight to the market and really getting a sense of that's kind of exactly what's going on. So I won't give too much of the answer. I might give us your thoughts on Pete's question about extra contributions and dollar cost averaging.
Right. This is a great question. So if you have an industry super fund, mm-hmm. and then, you know, depending on what sort of fund you've got, they might be investing. They might have a tailored portfolio. They might have a portfolio made out of ETFs, but essentially...
Or a retail fund. They both work the same.
Yeah. Every time you put your money basically gets invested. Yep. The more units of whatever that...
I love
you
this
know,
idea.
They get purchased. Mm-hmm. And every month, a little bit more. And that compounds because you can't really take the money out until, like, you know, you retire. So this is basically dollar cost averaging working every day.
Isn't that cool? I've never, ever thought about this exact analogy. But literally, to Doc's point, if you go to your super fund and say, what option do you want? They'll put you in balance to start with, and you can be balanced or you can be growth or conservative. Whatever option you choose, every single dollar you add to super, your employer pays it in. And this is not just, by the way, extra contributions, Pete. This is any contributions you make, your employer makes, into your super, assuming it's a retail industry fund. Self-managed, you can do your own thing, so it doesn't necessarily apply the same way. But that's the great thing about these super funds, right? They will say, well, your balanced fund says 60% shares, 40% property. That's more complex. Let's assume that's all it is. Then every dollar you put in, 60 cents will go into shares, 40 cents goes into property. Every single month or quarter, whenever your employer puts the money in, effectively the super fund is dollar cost averaging for you. And that's how we will all build, hopefully if we've got long enough left working and our employers are doing the right thing and contributing, that's how we're going to build retirement nest eggs, literally as in dollar cost averaging. Now, as you say, Pete, adding contributions is an even better way to do it, because if you put some extra money and a couple extra percent of your salary, then that'll happen exactly the same way. So yes, I would do that as well. But yeah, the very concept is a really smart way of doing it. If you think about dollar cost averaging, that's what the world, the nation's super funds are doing on our behalf. Any more, mate?
No. That's good.
Awesome. I got a follow-up.
Yeah.
So we had that was a great question asked by Pete. Nick Berger on Twitter, who is at the Real Burger 17. What if it's a real burger or just like the real burger?
Or Berger.
Berger? Oh, do you think?
Maybe he's a Berger, not a burger.
I'm going with Berger. I reckon Berger would be with the B. Nick Berger, okay. B-U-I-G. Anyway, Nick, feel free to hit us up and correct us if I've screwed it up. If Doc's right. Actually, if Doc's right, don't tell me because he's right about too much other stuff. I don't really need to hear it. Nick actually adds to it. This is also a fascinating question. This gets in a little bit of kind of policy, and you know I like to wonk out on policy sometimes, Doc. Nick says, further to that, which is Pete's question, do either of you see a day when members can opt into having a pre-retirement investment account you can contribute to regularly and leverage the big industry fund's diversification expertise, not bound by super legislation? Seems crazy that this doesn't happen. So not only did Pete's question blow me away, but Nick's answer blew me away too, because I'd never thought of this either. Imagine if you could basically say, I'm going to give some money to a fund who, there's no restrictions, there's no tax advantage, no restrictions, but as an investor, I can simply say, well, look, I love the job that Australian Super is doing for my super. I want to invest some money in a separate account, which is not a superannuation account at all. It's just an investment fund run the same way by the same people with the same opportunities and, frankly, the same low fees. I think that's a really, really smart idea. I'm actually kind of, I mean, I never thought of it, right? But now all of a sudden I know about it. And I'm thinking, why wouldn't they be doing it? You know, particularly the industry funds who have, in theory, a kind of a broader purpose. They're not just about making money for shareholders, but about helping their members make money. I kind of makes, why isn't Australian Super offering something like this?
That's an interesting question. I don't know why they don't offer. I mean, maybe.
Is that a great question?
It's a great question. Maybe people, I'm just speculating here. Maybe people figure that, you know, there are enough of these, like, you know, low cost ETFs that kind of cover that space. Like,
yeah,
if you go to like a Vanguard and you know, you just spend a few minutes on their retail pages, yeah. They'll tell you, okay, here's a conservative portfolio.
But you kind of got to build it yourself and invest in it yourself. And
you need to do the chores of buying.
If I could just send my money $500 a month to Australian Super and they could put it in an investment account for me.
Yeah.
And with a pre-mixed version of a balanced or conservative or growth or moderate, whatever it is.
That makes a lot of sense.
Doesn't it?
It actually improves. It would make our job less useful. Just saying, huh?
Well, we think you can actually do better than that by picking individual stocks, which is what we're here for. But quite honestly, I mean, you're right. But honestly, if we lose a couple of members to Australian Super and they end up better off as a result, I'm not going to lose any sleep over that one.
Okay, fine. Are they going to pay us a commission?
No. We're just doing it for the right reasons, mate.
Darn.
The more people that take control of their financial... That's what... Mate, just quiet this podcast for as well.
Mm.
We're not going to be paid any less for the podcast.
Oh, I thought we paid a lot. I thought we paid twice.
You waiting for the paycheck, were you?
Yeah, twice. Zero. Yeah, two zeros.
That's right. I'll increase to three, mate.
Okay, fine.
For this particular podcast, I'll pay you triple rates for the podcast.
Sounds great.
One more question. This has been a fun mailbag episode. You enjoying yourself?
I do.
How fun is this? So I will give a quick plug for the socials. If you want to hit us up, please do. At The Motley Fool AU on Twitter. At TMF Scott P, that's me. Or at Anir Barn Mahanti, that's Doc, on Twitter. Hit us up on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia, or Scott Phillips Money, all one word. Or on Instagram, at The Motley Fool AU, or at TMF Scott P. And if you're not on the socials, what's wrong with you? Get with the Instagram generation, the selfie kids, the kind of, you know, it's all about the selfies, all about the food photos. No, it's not. Anyway. You can email us at info@fool.com.au. Don't send me photos of your food. I really don't care. I'm only on Instagram because other people are, just quietly. I have very little use for it. Mate, the last question we had comes from Jonathan. Now, Jonathan references the fact that I may possibly have ranted at one point about ethical investing. I can't be sure. I may well have jumped on the high horse and complained about the greenwashing of people who...
I am sure you've done it.
Well, maybe. Who
you have done that.
If you weren't listening, I made the point that so-called ethical investing funds that do nothing other than basically just pick stocks and don't add any money to any ethical cause at all but make people feel better are at best a waste of time and at worst some decent greenwashing. That's reasonably stern words, but I stand by them all, and I'm backed by the CIO of Host Plus Con, Sam Cecilia. So anyway, that was my rant. So Jonathan says, well, what about an ethical investing idea or model like the Future Generation Fund? The fund managers work pro bono, and their fee is donated to charities instead, with the option to donate a percentage of it to the charity as well. Now, that's kind of, I kind of like this idea. If you want to invest ethically or you want to have an ethical impact, instead of paying a fund manager their fee, because they've probably got enough money already, you can simply divert that, and it becomes an effective ongoing donation to a charity of their or your choice. That is genuinely doing some good with your investing efforts. What do you think, mate? Is that a decent ethical investing choice?
I think it's interesting. I mean, the question here, the flip side would be that if these people are working pro bono,
mm-hmm.
are they actually doing, you know, like financial incentive is removed here, right? So are they going to just give you the rubbish stocks or are they actually giving you the good stock?
So because we mentioned the name of the fund, I will say outright.
Well, I'm not saying anything about that fund.
No, but I will say the people who are running it are reputable and well-known managers who have long track records and frankly don't need the cash. So the fact they're bothering to do this in the first place, I think we can assume they're doing it the right way. But as you say, I think that's a really, you know, we talked about behavioral investing a couple of times already. Think about who's making the decisions and what their motivations are is a worthwhile question.
Yeah, like in the exception to the rule, like so the Vanguard model where, you know, the Vanguard basically decided, you know, it's a not-for-profit organization, yep. right? And therefore they can drive the fees down. I mean, these are exceptions to the rule, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and this could be an exception rule, but that, can that scale? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think, look, I think, kind of, Jonathan, I kind of agree with you. I think, look, if you're going to pay, instead of paying a fund manager, you might as well pay a charity, right? If I'm going to pay 1% of my assets to somebody, it might as well go to someone who's doing some good rather than a fund manager who, frankly, already has three BMWs, a boat, and a you know, penthouse apartment. So they probably don't need the cash. And if you're going to pay a fund manager, I think it's a really smart way to do it. The only thing I would say, a bit like ethical investing, though, is you're probably better off maximizing your returns however they come and then doing some good with that money if you're so inclined. So if you know, these guys might, by the way, street the market and be well worth investing in for their own sake. But let's say you can get 10% with these guys or 12% with somebody else. The net result, the net increase of the 2% compounded is going to generate a heap more money for the charity of your choice, either every year or over the very long term. So you kind of, ethical investors, I think as a general rule, you are much, you either should be investing in impact ideas, literally funding things that wouldn't otherwise get funded, like wind farms if that's your thing, or microfinance in developing world if that's your thing, or in buying up plots of trees if that's your thing. Whatever your kind of ethical preference or concern is, investing in companies that only have sustainable working conditions, for example, another way to do it. So if you want to have what they call impact investing, actually adding money to the company, not just buying shares from somebody else, that's a really smart, ethical way to invest. If you want to otherwise, though, invest, generally speaking, and maximize your returns, you better do that and then donate some of the proceeds. That's far, far more effective than just thinking you're ethically investing by doing it some other way. Look, I don't think, if you're going to invest in a fund manager and Future Generation is delivering really good returns, then yep, absolutely donate the fee to charity rather than a fund manager. Great way to do it. So yes, I would go with that if you feel so inclined. Otherwise, just try and maximize your investment returns and then take some of those proceeds, some of the extra gains, and give some of those to charity if that's where you want to approach your investing in your philanthropy.
Be Buffett.
Be Buffett. Well, he's giving away 99% of his money.
Yeah, to like a lot of it is going to Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Correct. Right? They're doing so. It's a massive tangent. Have you watched the Netflix documentary?
I've actually watched two episodes.
I've watched them all. Inside Bill's Brain is the episode.
Yeah, it's pretty nice, eh?
Fascinating. So just really cool. It's kind of not too wonky, but it also goes like everywhere. They've talked about nuclear power. They've talked about sanitation. They've talked about his childhood, his marriage. Just a fascinating.
I just love the poop story. I'm not giving too much away, but yeah, watch it just for the poop story.
When you say not giving too much away, you're also kind of leaving us on a bit of a downer.
No, it's not a downer. So have you seen the emojis these days are about poops? And this is a fascinating story about poops, and I love it. And actually, everybody in my house says I talk too much about poops.
This is a tangent on a tangent, which is pretty impressive for us. We've gone from ethical investing to poop stories.
Yeah, poop stories. But I think, you know, watch it. It is really, really well done.
In all seriousness, the show. Some docos can be boring. Even Netflix docos can sometimes be boring. There's some great ones as well. Inside Bill's Brain, really, really cool one.
Yeah.
They are doing some wonderful things for society. Buffett is giving away, I want to say 99% of his wealth, mostly to Bill and Melinda's foundation, some of his family foundations as well. And look, that's 99% of a very, very, very large amount of money. Buffett could have otherwise just invested in, you know, wind farms and I don't know. What else is ethical these days?
Well, like, you know, I think that this is, again, as I said, I think the stuff that Bill and Melinda Gates are doing, like, you know, eradicating things like polio, for example, so this cool. is such a big, 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 big deal.
So cool.
Plus poop. I love, I just think that poop part is really awesome. So watch it. It's what I'll say.
That is the strongest sign that we've recorded way too long today, Doc. So with that, I wish I had another question to ask so we could kind of end on a different note, but.
That's a pretty good note to end.
I've got nothing.
Yeah. That's it then.
Before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. Normally I'd ask you to leave us a rating or a review, but after Doc's finished, maybe not this week. Leave us a review next week after we talk about something a little more uplifting and kind of investment worthy. And again, if you're going to tell your friends, get them to listen to the first three quarters of the podcast. Maybe, you know, cut it at the 40-minute mark. Probably best. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with a more usual dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.